Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. My name is Matt Harrington. I am your host, and we are going to be talking all about ABA research. In this podcast, we break down one ABA research article per episode, taking out the key findings for you so that on your morning commute or on your way into work, you can become a better behavior analyst. Now, let's get to the show. Hello and welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. This is our Friday episode, and I'm not going to lie, y'all, this is a spicy one. My name is Matt. This is the Behaviorist Book Club podcast. I'm so glad you're here. Let's continue our journey talking about supervision in all forms and fashions, and maybe hurt some feelings this episode. I'm not that guy who's, this will change the world. This episode will never, they'll make you never see this thing the same again. But I'm not going to lie, I was shocked by some of these numbers, embarrassed by others, and embarrassed for myself as a clinician in reflecting on my own practices. So if that doesn't get you interested, I don't know what to tell you. This one's a doozy. It's by Colin and Colleagues 2024, Procedural Integrity in Applied Settings, a Survey of Training Practices and Barriers, Behavior Analysis in Practice. That's right. We're back to BAP. Gotta love them. And this article, it was a tough read for, like I said, a bunch of different reasons. I think that when it comes to procedural fidelity for the average clinical BCBA, it's the stepchild of to-do list items. There's always going to be something else that you're supposed to do that takes priority. And there's so many times when we can conceptually agree that yes, procedural fidelity is one of the most important things to a behavior intervention plan running successfully, right? So when you see what's going on with your intervention plan, is your data being collected right? And is the fidelity of the intervention being delivered? Those two things are true and it's correct, it's going well. Then let's evaluate, is the function right? Or are these downstream things still doing well? But without fidelity and without integrity of your data, nothing else matters. However, as this study points out, this acknowledgement that fidelity is crucial is very common. But the actual practice of collecting highly effective and then using that procedural data is pretty bad. Just flat out, there's not a lot of data being collected on this as practitioners. This is also, when we talk about the research to practice gap, this is something that I think really highlights what that research to practice, clinic to research, whatever you want to call it, gap. So when it comes to the research to practice gap, it's not just this idea that clinicians and researchers are focusing on different things. I think that actually researchers know what clinicians need, primarily because clinicians have been guided by research for our entire career. Whether you know it or not, your practice was informed by research. Now, whether that research is 30 years old or 3 days old, that's a different story. The modern research affecting modern clinical work is a separate conversation. But research guiding clinical work, we're studying the same thing. Even the translational stuff, when we're like, all right, what does this specifically mean for clinical work? Maybe we need 5 more years to really dive into this topic. At its core, we're still being guided by research, right? However, I think really where the research to practice gap is in the type of resources that interventions are designed around and conclusions are drawn. Let's take just a simple example of extinction, right? So you're working with, the research paper comes out, they say that extinction, when applied, reduces problem behavior. Yes, 100%. That is the way extinction as a intervention works for challenging behavior. And then you take that same extinction protocol and you apply it to your client. And the only difference is that instead of a team of undergraduates and graduates who are highly trained in behavior analysis, the person that you're having apply your intervention is a 75-year-old grandma who has custody of the 12-year-old grandchild. That is a totally different experience for every single person in that party, and the intervention is going to be effective differently. And oftentimes, the thing that changes the effectiveness of the intervention is likely going to be the fidelity. When you go to have an intervention that's not working, you look fidelity, you look IOA, You look if there's any major environmental changes, like that's the resurgence, renewal, spontaneous recovery. And that is one of the big issues in research to practice gaps, is that oftentimes the challenges that clinicians face are totally different than the challenges that researchers face. So the conclusions that researchers draw end up being totally different than the conclusions that practitioners draw. If you're a good practitioner and hopefully you understand how to use research well, then you can identify those key nuggets, principles that a research paper is trying to highlight. That's what we do here. It's not to copy paste research, but to pull out the important nuggets and the things you can use in your own practice. 80 CEUs, $10 a month, 3 to 5 new CEUs being added every single month. Straightforward, simple. That's CEU Streamline. I created the Netflix of CEUs with all of not only my old content, but 3 to 5 new hours of CEUs being added every single month. Right now, we're at 85 videos and climbing more and more with over 400 behavior analysts getting all the CEUs they could dream about for only $10 a month. So if you're interested, go ahead and go to behavioristbookclub.com and click the link that says Streamline Info, or check the link below this episode. I know that you will love it, and I guarantee you that you will get all the CEUs you need at finally an affordable price. But if you don't have that skill set and you just try and copy paste research intervention to practice, like I used to back when I was a new clinician, but you're not going to get good results. And oftentimes the big thing that changes is procedural fidelity. We all know why integrity matters in terms of our procedures, right? We know we don't need to be sold on that. We all know, and the survey actually proves it, that we all know that this stuff matters. What I think we didn't realize is how commonplace the lack of procedural integrity was in clinical work. Procedural integrity in research has become extremely common. In fact, in a lot of places, I think JABA has this now, you actually can't publish without procedural integrity data. They don't accept your results, because to their point, if you don't have procedural integrity data saying that this data corresponded to what you wrote, then how do we know that what you wrote was the actual thing that was done? We don't. It could be a number of different confounds. However, there's not really a requirement for clinicians to have any type of procedural integrity data. I've never seen it required from an insurance point of view. It's very rarely required from any type of business that I've been a part of or any type of clinical director. I had one manager who demanded it at one point when I was having a problem with one of my clinical cases, but it was really rare. And really, they were just saying, have you given feedback to the person? But that was basically it. So there's not really any requirements for this to be collected, and so it drops on the priority list, which once again we'll talk about. So this study was a survey, which isn't ideal. It's not the perfect like review of all current practices, observe, et cetera, et cetera. But a survey is pretty good, especially for something like this. They surveyed on observation, data collection, data tracking, analysis, feedback methods. They also talked about common barriers. There was 140 BCBAs in this survey with about 5 years of certification on average. So a decent amount. Here are some of the key findings, and some of these really shocked me. One thing, not surprisingly, almost everyone knew about procedural fidelity. Most received grad school training, mostly lecture-based. Now, one thing that did surprise me, the first thing when I was reviewing this paper, is that only 41% of participants were taught using behavioral skills training. Meaning one of the most crucial things to do in our field, one of the most day-to-day tasks that we do, give assess errors and give feedback and then collect data on that feedback, less than half of the people in the study actually reported being formally trained through behavioral skills training, best practice for training on different tactics. So that off the bat tells you that we can't really be surprised that it's not happening, because there was no feedback. There was no role play. There was none of the components that actually get a behavior to occur over and over again implemented in the vast majority of behavior analyst supervision protocols. Even less training occurred around data tracking, analysis, and giving feedback. Some got on-the-job training, and about 40% pursued continuing education. Now, here's the thing. I love continuing education. I have CEU Streamline, an 85-plus CEU membership, growing by the month, hundreds of behavior analysts with hundreds of CEU hours of content. Continuing education should not serve the purpose of foundational skills that you need to succeed as a behavior analyst. Continuing education should keep you up to date with research, ensure continued skill development, go into more expansive explorations of our science, but something that is foundational to our day-to-day work should not be something that is pursued exclusively through continuing education. I sometimes see continuing education courses that are so foundational, running your first functional analysis. I understand why it exists. I've done an FA continuing ed credit before, but it's sad that we have that, right? Because functional analyses, not the formal 1984 one, but the concept of functional analyses are things that we have to do every day as a behavior analyst. We have to find if-then relationships and we have to manipulate variables. These are things that should be well and thoroughly mastered before we even step into a situation where we're billing insurance or in charge of client care. So while I'm glad that continuing ed exists as a pathway for those situations, it shouldn't be the primary option. What were the other findings in terms of integrity and practices? 94% observe staff regularly, weekly or monthly, which makes sense because we're all billing insurance or doing school. And that's part of the process. You're required to observe weekly or monthly. That's all good. Feedback was interesting. 90% provided feedback consistently. Almost all of it was in the moment vocal feedback, but only 20% used graphs to track their feedback. So what does that mean? That means in the supervision session, they observe something wrong happening and then they point it out and they give feedback and they correct the behavior and then they go on their way. This is how I did procedural integrity for the vast majority of my BCB time as a BCBA and still do now. The reason why is because this is the most effective way to give feedback and get a change in behavior because there's no prep work. You see something wrong, you correct it. The problem is that there's no data tracking. There's no, is this getting better or worse? Is your feedback effective or not effective? Is the change in integrity corresponding with a change in mastery level? Feedback is great. And what we're describing here is something that I think, as the survey pointed out, like everyone does, but the lack of data tracking is really significant here because you just don't know where to go next. Finally, moving forward, if those people were collecting data, only about half of them were actually using the data collected. This is likely those who were collecting data were just collecting it to collect it, right? Maybe it was part of the demands of their day-to-day job, but they didn't actually use it. At its core, people were giving feedback and not much else for procedural integrity. Barriers for this are what you'd expect. Lack of time, competing priorities, no formal systems, right? I think we all could have named those out of a hat. And essentially, they all come down to competing priorities, right? There are other things that have to get done during a client session. There are other things that have to get done during a client session. So you don't get to do the things you actually want to do. And there's really not much you can do on an individual level to change that challenge, right? Insurances are going to require billing. Businesses are going to require certain quality metrics. The best you can do as a business owner is to start to require some of those things and lean on the fact that outcomes matter more than nearly anything else in this business in terms of growing and scaling. But as a BA, you don't really have much wiggle room. So what can you do? We've talked a lot about how important it is. We've talked about the systemic difficulties. What can you do as a BCB? My recommendation is to always make things as easy as possible, especially when it comes to fidelity. The only time I've been able to really get good integrity data over and over again, consistent basis, is when I stop trying to make some other system work for me, some automated system, some like prompt or something like that came up on the data collection, and just use what worked for me. For me, that was Apple Notes. Every client had their own little note. Pop open that note, I take my quick data, and then I move on. At the end of the week, at the end of the month, when I have a free second, then I'll go through my notes and input everything into the graph. Is that perfect? No. Of course, there are a ton more things that I wish I could have done to track data on. Oftentimes, I was tracking data on the one or two key procedural integrity things that actually make a difference in the client's behavior. So oftentimes there are behavioral intervention components that I was looking at, and I didn't get to do as much data tracking on the skill acquisition side like I wanted. But for me, that was all I really had time for. And I had to be realistic about that, because some data is better than nothing, but of course, more data is better than almost everything. So I encourage you to start small, look at what you can do right now, and then as you progress through your BCBA career and as you get more fluent in all of these different technologies and tools, look to see what's going to work best for you and continue doing more of that. If it's Apple Notes, then do more Apple Notes. If it's a spreadsheet, do more spreadsheets. But if you agree with the 90%+ of BCBAs out there that procedural integrity is important, I encourage you to challenge yourself over the next week to actually take it, to really start some system. And once you start that system, see its usefulness, and I think you're going to really enjoy it long term. All right, that was a great week of podcasts. I will see you next week, continuing on with supervision. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. I hope you learned something, and I hope you continue to learn something as you tune in Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays to the Behaviorist Book Club. If you like this episode, consider leaving us a review, sharing it with a friend, and most importantly, using it in your clinical practice. There's no other reason why I do this than to make you a better behavior analyst and to make myself a better clinician. See you in the next one.